Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main with my co-host, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. You're not going to get me. You're not going to trick me. Hi.
Oh, okay. All right. We're not.
I don't know why I said that like you were a dog.
I know. You're not going to trick him as being a gracious co-host. He'll get you. Oh, my brother, right in your face. Hi, everybody.
And Brian Breshwood.
Oh, man. I was tempting fate. I took two sips of my drink during that intro, waiting for you to try to get me.
Oh, no. Those days are past. Or are they? One of the things we could talk about here is we started before the show, before Weird Things, talking about how there's Tumblr's, Bryce was just, you know, to the point of tears over Tumblr getting rid of porn. And is this guy's, he said it was a national tragedy. Am I lying, Bryce?
That is the way that I phrase that, yes.
Okay. Here's my case. And Tumblr is one of those kind of those early 2000s sort of phenomenons where, hey, everybody wants to have a voice. So we want to have a voice. And then around shortly after Tumblr, though, you got Facebook and you got Twitter. And a lot of times, like, my voice is, I just want to share this thing and offer a quick commentary on it. And that exploded. That got huge. And so you had Facebook, and then, Twitter never kind of grew to Facebook levels, but Twitter's like my favorite outlet because it's like, here's what I'm thinking. And that's kind of it. And then that sort of fell, like Tumblr usage didn't grow like everything else did. And then it got acquired by Yahoo. And then now it's part of Verizon, Auth and iVerizon, all that. And then again, Medium along. Medium was like, hey, like, to have a place, like, if you want to go to WordPress and have a WordPress blog, it's great. WordPress is great for that. If you want to, you know, just tell somebody, hey, I want to share this thing with you, Medium was kind of a neat idea. But I don't know, you know, what the status is of media is at this Medium at this point. But do we need a forum or do we need some way to, like, hey, I just want to write a thing and share it with everybody?
I think the question there really lies in what lessons did we learn and do we now infer from the blogging revolution? And that was really the precursor, even pre-social media, was the birth of blogs and then the empires built upon them. And now we are seeing kind of the remains of that. We saw a big, a sale at pennies on the dollar, at least from what they expected, of Mike to Bustle, which is another blogging platform. Bustle was also looking at buying some of the Gawker assets. Gawker probably was the larger empire that kind of rose the highest before, you know, much like Icarus and its wings of wax, it collapsed back down to earth. But now the question is, the business of blogging was built on top of display advertising. Looking at what display advertising was being sold for at physical newspapers, in newspaper websites. Now you could say, hey, look, we can slice, but by way of the niche nature of blogs, we can know exactly what our demos are. You can sell right to that demo, and that can be that. And then social media came along, and it became even more of a cost-effective solution to sell not only to exactly the demo, but also per click and per impression in a way that you really couldn't with a blog that you're selling, a buyout for a month or something like that. So now you have some of these blogging platforms that still exist that are still doing really well, like Verge and Vox and that kind of stuff. But even then, you're seeing consolidation. When now for the rest of us, the idea of, I want to write something, I want to just get it out there, I think that's kind of been left behind, in part cannibalized by the fact that we can get out to more people that we know via social media. But also now there's not really a business. Nobody has yet to say, people writing in kind of long form, that's the business that I want to be in, aside from, you know, maybe Medium, but even then they've kept trying to spin it out into like, oh no, we'll take it and aggregate it and be able to resell it on this very component-y sort of basis.
How does Medium make their money? Is it with advertising or do you pay for the service?
They have a paid subscription element to it. And then you give claps to articles that you like, and I think that's how they determine the share.
You give the clap to an article you
like. No, you do. You finish reading it and you go to the bottom and there's a little little clap button. Yeah, here you go. So this article has 172 claps, and so when if you're a paid Medium member, you click to give it claps, and those claps.
Interesting. So you pay to have a bigger voice as a consumer, not a louder voice as a producer.
No. But you don't pay. Do you pay per clap?
No, you only it's $5 a month, and give out unlimited.
You pay for the ability to have claps.
The ability to clap. Yeah.
Right.
And this, by the way, Medium was started by Evan Williams, co-founder of Twitter, he was looking for, you know, to solve the problem of Twitter, the short form.
That model doesn't, I don't know, that model doesn't really sound to me like that's the best form. It doesn't feel generalized in the way that display advertisements make a very generalized, or like if... I don't think I will ever be a paying subscriber to Medium, even if 10 blogs that I like to read go onto Medium. I don't think
I think
you'd have to be really invested in whatever in
those,
text.
Yeah, and I think the problem with those platforms too, where they want to go to like subscribe, like one subscription to pay for everything, is they're not really good if it's the first place your content appears in. And platforms that seem to do really well by, hey, we're going to, you know, pay a percentage out from this platform to you, tend to be ones where it's a secondary, you know, tertiary market for a creator. You know, Netflix would buy TV shows originally that had appeared elsewhere. If you're a TV creator, your goal was not to go to Netflix and then get a percentage of Netflix income like Spotify. Your goal was either to sell ancillary rights, or now Netflix to pay for your show outright, like they would for, you know, bid the same price. You know, and books, if I write a book, the first place I put my book if on Amazon is I don't make it available in the Amazon a la carte Kindle Unlimited, as I try to sell as many copies of this thing as I can, because the income I make from that, you know, hey, you know, read as much as you want, then we'll pay you a percentage, is much less than having that first market I put it into. And I think that's part of the problem. Medium, it's like, yeah, write your posts here and then you're going to get a percentage of this. But the problem is you run into is that you get some people who are, you know, a guy like when Bill Simmons was on there or whatever, he can get an outsized response and gets promoted within the system. And if you're an indie, it's even if you're, you know, it's easier to get 5 million claps than 5 claps, you know, I guess sort of what I'm trying to say at a certain point. Hmm. It was like Twitter, you know, they already decide winners and losers. And if you're in that model, you're at a disadvantage. It's like with Twitter, you know, Twitter has this, hey, we think you might want to follow Katy Perry. Like, man, you guys did a lot to build the Twitter brands of people who are already famous.
Yeah. And it's weird because in Twitter, right, the onboarding process, if you are trying to get people who maybe don't know about Twitter, you would want to put the most popular people in front of them, because like if my mom signs up for Twitter, she will be better served by being offered like Katy Perry or a news anchor than, you know, a podcaster, because that's a, you know, every new user is zero, you know, is no data yet. So that's tough to kind of have to be off of like the surface level knowledge.
So is there, and I get concerned, like, is there a need for something? I mean, I like the idea of just going to a website, getting a blank sheet, typing something up, having a link and being able to share. And there are ways you can do that. You have Google Docs, other things that could do that. Back in the day, remember Google Docs, originally it was, what was the startup they bought that you could actually just, there was originally just start creating a doc. It was such a genius, Writely, I think it was.
Okay. You know, and it was,
remember that? Like a genius idea of like, well, you know, we could just write it into a, you know, right into this page, and now you can do this. And so that was kind of cool. Now, I think what is it that Google does now is if you go to like
like there's a URL you type in, doc.
There are like URLs where it's like you type in the URL and it will just automatically start a new document or a new sheet or a new slideshow for you.
Yeah, I use and I've added some JavaScript bookmarklets. Like I have a Gmail this bookmarklet that sits inside of my favorite thing. So whenever I want to Gmail something and do that, a lot of those little kind of cool things like that. But yeah, they added some cool thing like that. But and you can share the stuff, but it's very kludgy to try to share it or you view it, you know, share it as a website or something like that. But I do think there's something for, hey, here's a long form thing I wrote. That's not going to live in the Facebook ecosystem. It's not going to live, you know, it's a thing that exists on its own. It makes discovery harder, which is, you know, part of the problem people are trying to solve with. But I think there's a lot of neat opportunity for longer form content. One, just be able to do it. But yeah, as far as to monetize it, you know, advertising, I don't think advertising is always the best answer. And I think sometimes it's the worst answer in some cases, not because I have a problem with advertising, just the what you get, you look at what's the compensation rate for YouTube.
Sure. Right. Yeah. You know, and that's kind of where the initial blogging revolution happened, you know, A, organically, which was kind of the amazing part about it. But then B, the business models were built on the same people that were being either felt left out or being fired from traditional media, which at that point was still vibrant enough that you could say, okay, well, I'm an editor. I used to work at New York Magazine. I know a bunch of freelancers. I know a bunch of places that I know a guy that sells ads. And if I tell him that these freelancers can get these impressions, then we can sell these ads. The spreadsheet works out. Let's all go do some cocaine, which is traditional journalism speak in New York City. So that now that's not the case, you know, the best that you can do, and you even started to see this 5-6 years ago, was every blog now does the daily deals. Look at these deals that are on Amazon. Look at these things. Why? Because Amazon affiliates is a very easy way that you can say, hey, look, click on a thing. Maybe you buy it. Maybe you don't. But now you're going to be in, you know, we're going to get that kickback for whatever you do buy. And when you were looking at that at scale, that's you know, can be a chunk of change for somebody. But again, you're relying on another action beyond what you are actually doing. It's very hard to make money on the written word, or at least in a way that matters, you know. And I almost wonder whether or not we look at it in the same way as a broadcast medium in the future, you know, or at least what the players that are still rocking and rolling with it, what that monetization structure looks like in the past, or sorry, in the future. Because I don't know if paywalls are it. You know, paywalls have always been very, very tricky to get people to pay for stuff, or to give them 10 free articles. And, you know, then I have to read the New York Times on my phone in private mode until I burn those 10 free articles. And display advertising isn't what it was, and God knows what it will even be in 10 years.
So I wonder if there's a possibility for us to go back to paying for everything. Because right now, what we don't want to do is bust out our credit card for anything. But I can see, and maybe it will be Bitcoin or something, but I could see a standalone currency that it's like you spend $100, you get 1,000 Jeep jobs, right? And then it's like, hey man, did you dig this? Click this button, and it's super easy to give me 3 Jeep jobs for it. And then, or it's like, hey, the rest of the article will cost you 1 Jeep job. And it's like, if I could break myself of thinking of it as real money and start to think of it as Warcraft gold or whatever, I think I'd feel a lot better. Like, I don't think I will ever bother to get a login or a whatever for the Wall Street Journal. When I'm out of my 5 articles, then I guess I'll read it next month, or maybe I'll do a VPN and see if it'll let me incognito my way in. But if I just had some version of reading Warcraft Gold, you know, sure, if it was as simple as just hitting a button and having some fake coins sent out, that would be really easy. And I think I wouldn't mind going back to paying for things.
I agree. There was very interesting, I was, you know, what, reading one of these books about kind of the early history of like the internet and whatnot, about how in the early 90s, you know, there was when we went for like the HTTP standard and we went for this sort of the idea of should you identify yourself to the server before you get authentication before you get something off a server or not, you know, and like the debate over like, was this a good idea? Because it seemed like great. Any OAuth documents open, like the natural state is to make these things available, accessible, whatever. So I can cross link, whatever, seemed like a great idea. But what was lost there was it made it harder if you wanted to put some sort of transactional thing interface in between there to say, hey, yeah, to read this page, pay 20 cents. Now it's, you can add these things, but at the early stages, it would have been easier to put it in place if we had a different way that the exchanges happen. It's been more eloquently explained by other people besides me. That was maybe that was divergent path number one, was that we said, hey, everything wants to be free. Information doesn't want anything. But, you know, that was one path we took, as we said, let's go for openness, whatever. The second thing happened, though, was like the resistance of the credit card companies, you know, to PayPal, to these other systems, because they like that 30 cents per transaction. They like that 30 cents they make per transaction, which meant you don't see a lot of things below a dollar. No, it's not worth it to sell anything for a dollar, for 50 cents or 25 cents because of, you know, the credit card companies and the reactions to that. And, you know, there was arguments too, like it's hard to do fraud protection for that. So, and it might be that, you know, we do have to go to Jeep Chops if we want this, because the system is sort of really designed not to make it easy to do 20. You know, they're like, oh, we'll put all your money into this account and you do this. Like, well, those, you know, end up being kind of churning operations. And there was a lot of that early stage internet, like, oh, just deposit $20 in here and now you can pay 20 cents to this. I got excited when Amazon, you know, looked like they were going to do like a more, you know, advanced payment system and stuff, because that looked like that can be cool. But it keeps falling apart. And then we have the problems now, too. Like, you know, you've had people who sell things that the payments operator don't approve of, you know, adult content, whatever, all of a sudden find themselves shut out. And that's, you know, a scary situation where, you know, thing that's totally within the law and free speech, but all of a sudden like, nah, we're uncomfortable with that. Now you can't use this platform and now you're excluded from selling this content. Yeah. Yeah. Gatekeepers love gates. That's why they're gatekeepers. So, Brian, I'm all for Jeep Chops.
And alternate to that, if not, you know, little Coinbase things, then maybe kind of a universal Unicard, where it's like you pay $40 a month or whatever, and then you just go wherever you want, and it turns all of everything into Spotify, where it's like you, maybe it's a plugin for Chrome or whatever, and you know, it allocates your $40 by who you visited or whatever.
You know, I love like alternative currencies, you know, different things. Like we've talked about this before. Like, do you know one of the biggest things has been in Africa and parts of the third world? One of the currencies they use because
cell phone minutes?
Yeah, calling cards.
It's like cigarettes in prison.
Yeah. What led for that to be such a large?
Everybody wants them, and it's unregulated by the government that can oftentimes make your currency worthless.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you can't tax minutes. You start swapping that stuff around.
And it has intrinsic value, which has been, you know, my criticism towards, you know, Bitcoin, things like this, is that, you know, they represent how much energy you use to create the thing, which no different than other things that we trade that, you know, don't perform anything. But cell phone minutes, like if I have 5 cell phone minutes, I get to use them to do things. And I think we may evolve into a system where it's energy credits or computational credits. You know, where, you know, you're going to be trading off, you know, processor access or energy points or something. I think that would be inevitable. But, you know.
Well, I mean, I guess the question then becomes, A, for writing, is it worth it for me to put the time in to write so I could get the Jeep Chops, right? Like, or at least just to make it so it's worth my time. Beyond getting my voice out there, getting my brand out there, like, is there something? Can I look at the end of the month and say, hey, this is cool?
Yeah, I think that, and we've talked a bit about like with podcasting and stuff, like the project I'm working on with Audiomatic, you know, which is, hey, I think there's this nice space between podcasting and audiobooks that, you know, maybe could be filled. And yeah. I think that there's in the writing thing, and, you know, like I could see that there are things, I would like to write longer form content, but nah, I don't want to, it doesn't need to be an ebook. It doesn't need to be an ebook, but it should be something that, like, you know, if I, here's $2 to read this cool thing. And, you know, there have been tons of platforms that allow you to sell digital downloads. That's nothing new, but it's the figuring out the simple.
Well, look, I mean, for me, you know, I wanted to start writing every day again. And it's something where I've run a couple blogs and I've written every day for large stretches of my life. And I had not. So I wanted to do it. And the question was, in 2018, like, I used to run blogs. Now I don't. It's 2018 now. What do I do? Like, where is even just a place that is better than just shouting into the void to write on a regular basis? Do I just make a more? And so I tried a few things. I tried Facebook. That was a disaster. And either I was poorly formatting longer form stuff on my personal page that, you know, there was a reaction, but it was like, eh. Okay, I don't really know what I'm getting out of this. I don't think I'm gaining any followers on Facebook. And then it was like, all right, well, maybe I'll try Medium. And I wrote a few things on Medium, and it just kind of felt like shouting into the void, you know, and that was that. But eventually, the key was start a newsletter, because at the very least, you know, I got people's emails, and I can let them know when I have things that I want to do and when I have things that there are important. And so if I wanted to write about politics every day, that was really the only thing that I could think of for which I would be happy at the end of the day. And now we have about 1500, you know, a 1500 person mailing list that goes out 5 days a week that are used to reading my work. And like, I just know, okay, that's a thing. It's a thing that I have, that I feel good about the time and effort that I put into it. Because other than that, man, outside of, you know, what made blogging so exciting in the aughts was, man, it was really a flat area where it's like, if you wrote every day, you could probably email somebody that worked at a bigger blog and say, hey, what's your freelance stuff? Or I have an idea for an article. Can I write? You know, who writes on weekends? Yeah. Do you mind if I do that? And it's like, it was exciting. There was you know, it was new. There was a possibility for advancement. And also I was younger, so it took less for me to be happy with, you know, doing something with my effort. But now it's like, well, crap. Like, what is even worth the time to do it in a world where everything is available and everything is free? And I'm already reading, you know, more than I probably read in blogs, just scrolling Twitter every day.
Well, and we've been talking a lot about like monetization, but I also think that part of the reason like none of these platforms have taken off is because they don't have very good community elements to them, right? Like Medium does have commenting, and I think they've got like you can quote stuff and it'll see what the most quoted stuff is. But I don't see like I you know, we talked about you know, what if you could give some fake currency to the articles that you read or whatever links that you were being sent to. And I look at like Reddit, which is more of an aggregate system, but they are able to sustain themselves as an aggregate for people giving them money for not making anything new, for just aggregating links to other sites. And that is because the Reddit community for everything about it is rather tight-knit, right? It's built to make communities and to reinforce those communities. And when you have a community that, you know, becomes as fortified as it is, then it starts to have appreciation for the system underlying it. And for Reddit, that's not original content. No one at Reddit is being paid to write anything. And yet that is one of the top community spaces in the world. And I don't know that you can create a good blogging platform that will have interoperability without a community space.
I think that there are two different needs you want to try to address there, though. One is, I just want a platform where I can share this thing with everybody. And I have this one thing to say. Reddit has become this amazing phenomenon in that, right? I mean, like, to me, like two of the most kind of important stories of the last 10 years, really, I think of Twitter and Reddit for me almost, as far as the, for the average person being able to reach out. But that's one thing. But if you're a Justin or a Brian and you have a following and you say, I have a following, I can point people in a direction. I just need an incentive to say, go here and go do this. I need an incentive to sit down and spend, you know, 5 hours writing this thing, because otherwise I'll just do a fun couple quick tweets and I'm done. I need an incentive to do this. I need a platform that captures that incentive, I guess, which is different, where it's not so much I don't need a community for it. I just need to be able to take the people who already have and go, hey, over here, here's the thing I did, and this is how I get compensated. Or a thought. I mean, speaking of which, let me ask you about your 1960 election project.
Yes. Yes.
What is the business model behind that?
The business model is kind of twofold. Number one, the model is I want to, well, without kind of getting into, all right, well, screw it, whatever, we're here. Part that was a big question of like, all right, so either I can put this whole thing together and then I can shop it around to some people and say, all right, with X amount of expectation of listeners, I can try and sell it as like a title, a titled sponsorship kind of thing, right? And I can catch money on the front end for an advertiser. That's traditionally what the model is for those kinds of podcasts, is you have a project, you shop it around, you see who wants to pay for it, and that's that. That's hard for me because I don't have a history in doing it. You know, the audience that I have for Politics, Politics, Politics or Night Attack or anything like that is not enough that we could say, hey, Squarespace, we could do this. Now I could try and find somebody that has relationships with those brands and say, hey, look, we really like, this is a bit of a flyer and we'll take a lesser amount now. But if you want to be there for when we do season two, then this would be, you know, good faith and I could, you know, use that. Or, and this is probably what we are going to do, is to kickstart it and to basically get it, the majority done, and then, you know, kickstart the ability to hire on a professional engineer to kind of make sure that it has all the polish of something that you would hear on Gimlet or NPR or Slate, and basically get the money from the fans up front, and then depending on what the reaction is, you know, either say, all right, well, season two, now we'll be able to go to Squarespace or Allbirds or HelloFresh or something like that and go from there. Or, you know, the business model is the same way that the same thing we do every night, Pinky, launch a Patreon. you know, monetize it from there, with the idea being that that would probably be a monthly thing where part of this would be, all right, I'll have some kind of content that will definitely be out every month for people, but the podcast would only happen maybe once or twice a year, depending on what we do. So that's kind of the business thought around it. My initial thought now is to kickstart it, because it would be kind of a double solution of, A, nothing really gets people excited about things like Kickstarter. Kickstarter is an event, you know, it is the beginning of something. And if I were able to offer like, hey, I'm going to do this, but I'm enough of the way down the road, I've recorded enough of my own stuff, I've aggregated enough of the media, but I could probably even have a editor sort of have like episode one, maybe two close to being done, and then have the stretch goals be additional content that we could do, that I could kind of get the best of both worlds. I could get money to pay for talent, and I could get people excited enough that now it gets a little bit of momentum out of the gate, where everybody that I know is talking about like, oh, look at this thing, it's really cool, hey, let me share it on social media.
Have you considered doing like, I guess I don't know exactly how Dan Carlin does it, but doesn't he like cut his stuff up as like iTunes things and puts them out?
No, he lets them for free for so many days, and then after that they go for $1 an episode in the back catalog. And the way he's made it work is he's constantly creating new stuff, and he has this giant, immense back catalog where people can spend dollars and dollars and dollars at a time.
There was someone though early on who was like using, effectively like using iTunes or at the time, yeah, the music download sites as a medium for not a premium podcast, but it would be like, here's $1 or $2 for this hour long thing.
I know Sigler took his audiobooks and serialized them on podcasts.
I thought that was how Hardcore History was early on, but I don't know.
Possibly. About, the only issue now is that, man, it is such a crowded genre, and the talent that is there right now is something that I can't break through. And also to this point, this still to me is something that I need to prove that I can do. And so the Kickstarter thing has become more attractive to me, not because even it's like, you know, I would like to not go in the red on the project, right? But I also just want people to listen to, I really just want it to be something that is heard, and I want it to be good. So I just need to kind of get it out there, and putting any kind of paywall as the initial kind of like, how do you do, is just, I think, a non-starter when some of the best people in public radio aren't going into public radio because they want to talk about grisly murders in awesome and awesome cadences with awesome microphones with awesome editors.
All right. So issue resolved. Problems. You know.
Nailed it. You're welcome, world.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's the right thing. That's just kind of where I am with it now.
I don't know anybody knows what the right thing is. And I think that it illustrates, though, that kind of the, you know, we get, I'm sure Bryce and Brian, you get this too, but Justin and I, we get this too all the time. It's like, hey, we're such and such starting this new podcast network, and, you know, we'd love for you to have you guys. We have a new app and this thing going on board and monetization, and, you know, we're going to do ads and we're going to do this. And it's like, you know, this has been going on for, you know, forever. And that's people like entrepreneurs go like, here's my solution. These people have this content. We'll find it, you know, we'll sell ads on it to an audience and be this distribution platform. That's our genius idea, where it's like, well, what's the value you're bringing? You know, the value you're bringing there really is how to extract value out of that relationship from the creator and the audience and put it in your pocket, where there are real solutions to be found out there for, like, how do you help people find cool stuff? How do you help creators either grow their audience or get compensated and paid for it or make their life easier? You know, solve one of those things, great. Solve all four of those things, wonderful, wonderful. And every now and then something comes along that does a good part of that, at least, you know. So solve that. We're asking you to solve that, people. Solve it.
Yeah, get on that.
Get on it.
We want to buy Tuesday.
Today's Monday, any picks?
You know, I don't have any really strong picks outside of say I did finish. I think we discussed it last week. I finished the rest of Homecoming, and it's quite good. Watch Homecoming.
I have a pick. I think I mentioned this last week. So I guess this is more of an update. I've been going back and watching Futurama.
Yeah,
and so I just got through the first two movies. What is it? Bender's Big Score and The Beast with a Billion Backs, and both of those are very good. And I've just started Bender's Game, which is like not paced well.
Oh, really?
It's you know, despite the fact that it's like on Hulu, they're split up into episodes the way that they put them on TV, but it's like the concept doesn't even make sense. And then it's like,
are they riffing directly on Ender's Game, or
No, I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to be able to say. But it's like, oh, we got this crystal, and the crystal is what made black matter a thing. But then there's that anti-crystal, and they can't touch, otherwise it's useless. And then
I wonder what will happen.
But then, like, the whole conceit of, like, oh, well, you know, it's actually, like, there's like a D&D element, and they're in the world of Dungeons and Dragons because of a weird thing. It's all really kludgy in a way that the first two of those movies ended up making feeling like they made more sense in world. So I don't know. That's the Futurama update for today.
You know, this is a book that's more of a, it's almost photo essay, whatever, but it's also a great introduction to, you know, Marshall McLuhan is the medium is the massage, which was, you know, take on his essay, the medium is the message. And the book is actually put, McLuhan, and also it was Quentin Fiore was the guy who did the actual design of it. Marshall McLuhan is a guy that was an amazing, amazing thinker about media, and really is the media landscape expanded considerably in the 60s with TV and print and everything else. He made wonderful observations on things, and it's not so much, you know, he'd have this concept of a probe, which was just sort of kind of a question to ask. Oh, there's a version of it, which was illustrated by Shepard Fairey, that Bryce has found. But anyhow, I'm a fan of the original. The point is he asked very interesting questions. He was very good at looking at things and saying, is this a hot or a cold medium? Meaning, like, you know, are you engaged with it? Or are you just receiving from it? You know, the difference between radio and television. He had these insights that were actually just really helpful for looking at stuff. And we don't really have a McLuhan of the modern age, which was sort of, you know, he would probably give us a lot of insight into, you know, a lot. He's very good at sort of framing and say, look at it this way. And it provides a lot of, you know, insight into stuff. And, you know, if from talking about how, you know, I can't do any of it justice, but I really, Marshall McLuhan, check him out. Look at what he had to say about a lot of stuff. It was a very insightful way. And it's a really good lens to look at things today. So.
I remember. So, a tribute to the fallen 41st president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, got me thinking about books that I've read about the Bush 41 White House. Among them, my favorite is War in a Time of Peace by David Halberstam. He is one of Halberstam is one of the best nonfiction writers of all time. His most famous book is The Best and the Brightest, all about the Vietnam War. So he has connections for days within the Pentagon, but it focuses on the Bush and Clinton White Houses, and specifically a fight within the Pentagon to basically say the era of boots on the ground is over, and that the United States should stop being the authority of dropping troops on the ground, because now it was the ascendancy of the Air Force that we as the Air Force can basically solve any conflict that we want via air power. What we wind up getting from here is a very testy exchange in Rwanda, where the United States was very slow to react because we wanted to let some of the African nations handle conflicts that were in Africa. We saw what happened in Bosnia and Slobodan Milosevic, that eventually wound up with NATO going in to take care of things that were effectively the United States military wearing NATO hats. It's a fascinating look into power that is non-political. You know, it is about a lot of these people, a lot about the leadership that both of them, shown. But go ahead and check that out. And something free, it just made me kind of happy and was a bit of a bygone era, specifically considering just, I thought, a not only disgraceful on a comedic level, but just an unfunny, stupid and recursive kind of Saturday Night Live sketches about, you know, basically like the most lowbrow, haha, Trump and Putin are gay, a comedy. That there was a great clip. It's on C-SPAN. You can look it up. You can just Google Dana Carvey Bush Christmas, and it was literally weeks after George H.W. Bush had lost to Bill Clinton that he invited Dana Carvey to the White House, that of course had done the very famous kind of impression of George H.W. Bush on Saturday Night Live for many years. And it just is kind of, I don't know, it just made me happy that there was a moment in which we could have, you know, a parody that was, you know, at times not flattering, right? But he obviously got it, and he really liked it, and he thought it was really funny, and invited him over. And just the idea that, like, hey, look, there was a time in which we could talk about our differences and maybe even make fun of each other and not wanted to end with arterial blood being sprayed on the walls of our internet dialogue.
I assume it was after this, but I remember there was a time that Dana Carvey came back to host Saturday Night Live, and during the monologue, he was doing a Bush impression, and then Bush, the actual Bush, interrupted to correct him on. He was like, "And what is this Naga Da thing? I don't say that. That's not even." It was really charming and adorable.
There's another great pick. One of my favorite stand-up specials of all time is Dana Carvey's Critics' Choice. But he does a lot of funny kind of a whole bit about going to visit the Bush White House and, you know, whether or not Bush. Yeah. And who knows how much of this is the shtick and how much of this is, you know, built in truth. But Bush saying, you know, the only thing people are going to want to ask you is whether or not you did it in the Lincoln bedroom. And he's like, well, I'm not going to tell you. But my kid's middle name is Abe.
Sorry, I just had a little mute issue there. I've had friends and family that have been involved in Secret Service and have gotten to know a number of the Bush family. And let's set aside how our politics makes us filter the way we look at people for a moment. You know, instead of the other guy bad, wrong party. And I like it. It's wonderful to be able to talk politics across the table and not through strawman filters of other people's points of views. I've heard a lot of stories about politicians behind the scenes, you know, people I know who are on campaign trails, things like this, been around. Always heard wonderful things about Bush 41. Touching stories about, you know, kids visiting at Camp David and a little girl upset she lost her tooth, and because she couldn't find the tooth fairy wouldn't come. And 41 pulling out a pen and writing a letter from the President of the United States saying, I certify that she lost her tooth and is entitled to what is due to her from the tooth fairy. Little things like this, Barbara Bush making cookies for the kids and stuff. And I've heard this about the other Bushes too. I've heard about his kids. I've heard about it, the compassionate generosity of very, very, and there might be, I'm sure there are stories out there, but I've heard everybody I've known from in different political stripes have talked about how they've just all across, you know, very, very nice people, you know. I haven't heard any Neil stories, but I've heard, you know, Jeb, George Jr., but I haven't heard anything about Neil, but Jeb and George, both same thing. Yeah.
Here's all I'll say. And there's, I know, there's the ever raging Twitter question of, you know, okay, well, somebody dies, and then there's people that are mean to the person that dies. And then it's like, in my personal view, your mileage might vary, is that we have the entirety of history to detail every negative thing that might have happened. You know, of course, people care less about it when they've been dead for a while. But then again, I do care about it, which is why I'm doing a whole thing about an election that happened freaking 60 years ago. So that being said, I don't know. Listen to Politics podcast so that I can explain my thoughts.
Gentlemen, anything else?
That's it.
No.
It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.